The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Meet Jordan Tristan Walker, a director of research and development strategic operations and mRNA scientific planning at Pfizer.
But you do like things like selective directional mutations to try to see if you can make more potent?
Yeah.
So there is research ongoing about that. I don't know how that's going to work. There might not be any more outbreaks.
The gentleman seems to have absolutely no moral compass at all.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. That was a big undercover video. I don't know if you followed any of this story or not. Last week, Project Veritas, the undercover investigative journalist group, they're started by a guy named James O'Keefe. They released a video of a guy named Jordan, I think it was Tristan Walker. And he was talking with one of the reporters at a bar. Walker was the director of worldwide R&D, strategic operations, mRNA scientific planner at Pfizer. And he's been yanked. He was on LinkedIn, yanked from LinkedIn, but the Project Veritas got him before that happened. We don't know if he's still, you know, what his role is after this video has been released, but he very freely, as you could hear in part of that audio, tells the investigator that the company is doing research on what they call directed evolution. Now, this is frightening stuff. Dr. Harvey Risch is going to be joining me. I'm going to get his take on this as well. They're doing research on directed evolution. You're saying, well, what is that? Directed evolution on what? On the COVID virus. And he made a distinction. He distinguishes this from gain of function, which is, you know, what is being done at the Wuhan lab using, of course, taxpayer money. But how much of a real difference there is, you know, I'm not quite sure. That's debatable. I'll find out from the good doctor. But Walker also called the vaccines. Now, listen to this. He called them a cash cow. A cash cow for Pfizer. And they are. I mean, look at the money. If you could invest in a stock, could you imagine before COVID-19 if you owned Pfizer stock? He didn't really say anything when the investigator suggested releasing one of those viruses that Pfizer could come to the rescue and immediately, you know, they'll have a vaccine to counter it. A second video showed Walker exploding at O'Keefe and assaulting him after O'Keefe confronted him about the interview. And Pfizer, interestingly, didn't say anything at all until Friday after 8 p.m. Eastern, and they issued a press release. And this is what Pfizer said. In the ongoing development of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, Pfizer has not conducted gain-of-function or directed evolution research, end of quote. So they're denying it outright, totally. Yet later on, they indicated that they might actually be doing those experiments in order to see if there might be strains that might be resistant to their vaccines and to their drugs. You imagine that if that got out, right? So I sit back and I say, which one is it? Which one is it? MIT professor, there's a guy named Restiv Levy, who deals with medical data analytics. He's called for the complete withdrawal of the use of mRNA vaccine, and he and his colleagues, they researched emergency medical service calls for cardiac events in Israel before and after the vaccine rollout. What they found was stunning. A 25% increase in cardiac-related emergency calls in men 18 to 39 immediately after the rollout. And after other research, he said, this was in a video he posted on Twitter, this is clearly the most failing product in the history of medical products, both in terms of efficacy and safety, and we need to investigate and think hard. How do we end up in a situation that is almost, which is the most profitable medical product in history of medical products? A lot to talk about today. Dr. Harvey Risch returns. He's a professor emeritus of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine, and one of the leading voices on bringing clarity when it comes to these vaccines. And you can join us. If you've got a question, feel free to join us. 888-914-9149. Dr. Risch, thanks for your patience, and thank you for coming back once again. It's always good to talk with you.
Happy to be with you.
So what are we to make of what Pfizer said? That, you know, are they doing gain-of-function or directed evolution research or not? What do you think? And is that what is normally done by pharmaceutical companies? Do they want to try to preemptively, you know, thwart some variant of the virus?
So those are two very different questions, actually. Gain-of-function research is a generic kind of consideration where you make an organism more able to do damage one way or another, either to be more infectious, to be more invasive, more toxic, in some way you make it more viable to do what it does as a pathogen. And in the case of the COVID-19 virus, that means either making it more toxic or making it more infectious. There isn't that much room to make it more infectious at this point. The most recent variants after, a dozen strains and substrains that have kind of populated around the world have gotten it to about as infectious as measles, I think. And, if measles could be even more infectious, it would be. And given that it's been around for so long, it hasn't done that. And I think COVID is probably getting close to its maximal infectivity. And the reason that we see new strains popping up, or new substrains, everything is all Omicron, but new substrains popping up from time to time, is that people are losing their immunity to either vaccine immunity or natural immunity to the existing strains that have been circulating, that makes them more amenable to getting something of the same amount of infectiousness as what they already had. It doesn't mean that the new substrains coming out are more infectious. It just means that they've lost some of their ability to resist them, and that gives a niche for the new ones that have escaped from the previous immunity to be able to try to get a foothold in the population that way. There's always this competition.
Yeah, I'd heard that there are at least a half a dozen versions of the virus moving throughout the United States, but they're part, I guess, of the same family tree. So are there new COVID variants circulating? I know we have the XBB 1.5. That's the dominant subvariant out there. What's happening on the COVID front?
That is the main one. There's another one, was it CA 1.1, something like that, that was, there were some news reports suggesting that it was growing somewhere in the United States. CDC has said as of Friday that the percentage that it's estimating has actually gone down a little bit, that it peaked about 2 weeks ago at 2%. Of COVID infections, and now it's down to 1.7%. I don't know if that's meaningful or not. It doesn't suggest that it's making major inroads against any of the dominant strains, which is the XBB 1.5 and the BQ subvariants.
So is COVID over? I know the World Health Organization says COVID remains a global emergency, right? It remains a global... But the pandemic, they say, could near its end in 2023. And they estimate that at least 90% of the world's population has some level of immunity right now towards COVID due to vaccination or infection. How do you see those numbers?
Well, the CDC has already said on its website that above 95% of the American population has immunity either from vaccine or infection based on serology testing of blood donations through June of last year. So it's, it's close to 99% now of everybody has had COVID or is immune to COVID. The fraction of people overall who've had COVID based on natural immunity is upwards of 50%. So it's probably 55 or 60%, might even be 70%. Now, it keeps growing, and natural immunity is not perfect, but it's as strong as vaccine immunity, if not somewhat stronger. And so, we're always going to, we're stuck now with an endemic virus that's not very damaging and really constitutes more of an annoyance. Yes, there are some people who are frail, who have chronic conditions, for whom the infection could be life-threatening. But for the great majority of the population, it's more of an aggravation and an annoyance to get through than anything else.
Yeah. Our number here, if you want to get in, 888-914-9149, give you an update on COVID. As I said, I saw the World Health Organization say, hey, we could see the end of the pandemic by the end of 2023. I kind of feel like we're out of the woods already. And yet you see stories like others that have been reported. There was a Dr. Leanna Wendt, public health professor, George. You're laughing already. I love it. George Washington University. She says children under 5 are now eligible for this vaccine. And wasn't Wendt the head of Planned Parenthood at one point in time, too? I think she was.
Yes, she was.
So children under 5 now eligible for vaccine. Should we be vaccinating kids?
No, we should never have been vaccinating kids. There was never a reason to vaccinate kids, only kids who have very serious, you know, chronic conditions. Kids who are obese or have diabetes, there's a discussion about whether to vaccinate them. But for normal healthy kids, there's no reason to vaccinate them. Denmark switched off of recommending vaccination for anybody under 50. You know, they said in that recommendation that the vaccines do not control spread of the infection. And this is their government website saying this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the CDC that says that the vaccines don't control transmission.
Yeah, so Wen says, hey, vaccinate those five-year-olds or younger. Is there a problem vaccinating them? We got this mRNA, and I know we've talked about this in the past, and our audience always changes, but does mRNA do anything to the child's DNA, or does it affect them in ways that we should be concerned about? We know in young adult men, we see a rise in myocarditis. We see all sorts of other issues as well with menstrual cycles and things along those lines. Is there an inherent danger in giving the kids a COVID vaccine?
Well, you know, we just don't know the long-term hazards. And, I think one should always take the side of prudence when one is uncertain. Uh-huh. And that's just a general rule of medicine, if not life. So there's no benefit to be gained. There's only room for harm. Because no healthy kids have died from COVID, essentially, virtually zero, statistically zero.
Right.
So where is the potential gain to be acquired by vaccinating kids?
Right. All right, let's do this. We'll grab a couple calls. 888-914-9149. My guest today, Dr. Harvey Risch. John is in Silver Springs, Maryland. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. I'm curious as to whether or not the vaccine mitigates symptoms. I have yet to see any studies at all that it actually does mitigate the symptoms of the COVID.
That's a great question. Doctor, can you address that?
So there are some studies that have looked at what they call serious outcomes from COVID or hospitalization from COVID. And some of them purport to show that vaccinated people who get COVID have milder symptoms, meaning that they don't get hospitalized as frequently, or the particular serious adverse events of COVID itself were less frequent. I don't think that evidence is very strong. I think that you have to know the behaviors in the countries where you do these kinds of studies. For example, in China, people go to the hospital for primary care, for the simplest medical consideration that you Americans would look online to figure out what to do. The Chinese rush to the emergency room. So it's really hard to know exactly what these studies represent. And so right now I'm not drawing any conclusions about whether the vaccines reduce the severity of COVID that you would get in a breakthrough infection or not. It's possible they do a little, but I haven't seen.
Well, that's what they were saying for a long time. Remember, they were saying if you got this, if you got COVID, it wouldn't be as severe. So it was one of the claims that were being made. And to John's question, we're not really seeing any evidence of that, or we are?
Well, there is some evidence, but it's not strong and not definitive.
Right. Right.
And the other thing I would point out about that is those claims only arose when the claims that the vaccines prevented getting COVID fell apart.
Yeah, it's
that,
so true.
You know, it was that was their backup claim.
Yeah.
Because the claim of why you should get vaccinated because the state, the government, your hospital, your school tells you have to be vaccinated. When the rationale for that fell apart, then they went back to but you'll benefit personally.
Well, all right, well, we'll move along. A lot of questions coming in here, doctor, on blood transfusions. I mean, it's bizarre. We got a lot of them. So, and thank you for your call. Let me move along. We'll go to Twin Cities. Chris, who's up next, Maggie? Which one? Chris in Michigan. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you. Yes, my question about blood transfusions. Let's say I didn't get the vaccine, but I go into the hospital and I need blood because I'm having an operation. If the blood donated was from someone who had gotten the vaccine, do I now have the RNRA in my system through that blood transfusion?
You might, actually.
Wow.
And we don't. This is another total unknown. What might matter is how much. You might have the spike protein. Whether you get the mRNA is probably unlikely, but you might have some spike protein floating around, which means that it's not likely to reproduce and make large amounts of it. Whether it would trigger your immune system to respond to it is kind of unknown. Whether it would bind to anywhere is kind of unknown. This is really uncharted territory.
Fascinating. Good question, Chris. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Corey is in the Twin Cities. Corey, good afternoon.
Thank you. See, I've been trying to donate blood for like 9 months now and won't, because when you read the fine print, it says that you cannot opt out of a clinical trial that's studying your blood and malaria. And was just wondering if you know if there's any connection to malaria and COVID. Why are we studying this in the United States? Just your prompting, or you talking about the blood donation research had prompted that question. I was wondering if you could help us understand.
Great. Thank you very much. Doctor, you want to address that?
So this is the first I've heard of that. And the only interesting little observation I would make is that hydroxychloroquine is used to treat both COVID and malaria.
There's the connection. Fascinating. Corey, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
It's fascinating. Boy, that's a really interesting bridge. I didn't think of that. I saw, speaking of blood, since we're talking about that right now, and if you want to join us, 888-914-9149. We're talking COVID variants and where we are, the latest science that's now coming out, what you need to know. I saw an article that the FDA is proposing regarding blood transfusions or blood, giving blood. A proposal would allow gay men in a monogamous relationship to donate their blood. Do you have any concerns over that at all, or does that give you some reservation?
The concerns are what kind of filtering and screening is done on blood products in general, not who is providing it. So, the blood banking system has to be vigilant about accepting blood that could be infected one way or another, and it's for them to figure out how to screen. That's a whole technology level way above my pay grade, as to what they do to do all that screening.
My guest today, Dr. Harvey Risch, and we're talking about everything here. I'm going to get back to COVID and the vaccines before we take more calls, because there's something else that's floating around that some women of reproductive age have had noticed slight increases in the length of their menstrual cycle shortly after receiving the jab. And I know there's been some concerns also just about fertility. Does the COVID-19 vaccine affect either of those things?
The prolongation of menstrual cycle length for some cycles has been observed. The federal government, CDC, has agreed that that happens on average. The issues on fertility is pretty much indirect evidence. The CDC studies have suggested that they're not seeing much in the way of reductions in fertility, but I have a lot of trouble believing much of what comes out of CDC studies these days. The indirect evidence is in birth rates that have dropped in countries since the vaccines were rolled out. Now, the reason for that might have to do both with the vaccines as well as with behavioral changes, lockdowns, and all sorts of circumstances. Socioeconomic status changes because of lockdowns and so on, that it's hard really to take apart. And so I think the evidence proving that is kind of iffy. And, I think that Naomi Wolf has put together a lot of evidence for that. But I'm not, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. Certainly a lot of women who've reported stillbirths, they think are a tribute to their vaccination. For me, it's really hard to know quantitatively speaking, and until we figure out how to do some kind of adequate study that controls for all sorts of things that makes it believable.
All right, our number here, 888-914-9149. I know the phones fill up pretty quickly. Jesse in Minnesota, good afternoon. Thank you for calling in.
Good afternoon. Thanks for hearing my question. I'm just wondering how the CDC is gathering information about subvariants. It seems like with all the at-home testing, and just very few people going into the hospital. I'm wondering how they can be so certain as to the subvariants and what percentage of people are carrying the subvariants.
Well, that's an interesting question. The CDC has sampling techniques all around the country where it's getting testing results and samples from them and does sequencing on the genetic material to figure out what the variants are. And, it's not just in the donated blood studies, which they've done both in 2020 and 2021 and into 2022, that they're saying they're doing through the end of I think, I'm not sure if they're still doing it in 2023, but they do have sampling methods that they're using, and they're posting that data on the CDC website, on the variant proportions website, and they show on Fridays, Friday afternoons, it becomes available to see what their sequencing tells them about which variants are in circulation.
All right. Jesse, I hope that helps. Go ahead. I'll let you follow up.
Are they testing then like human waste from, water waste facilities to find that information also? And then if they can test that back to DNA in humans, do we have permission? Are we giving people permission to test that?
Well, they are doing wastewater sampling, and so it's possible that some of the information comes from studying those kinds of samples. I'm not sure about the permission, to test all this, but that's part of how the CDC operates as a public health agency.
Jesse, thank you. It's good questions. Kathy's in North Bethesda, Maryland. She's got a question for you, Doctor. Good afternoon, Kathy.
Good afternoon, Drew. Good afternoon, Doctor. I've got a question about the mRNA. How long does it stay in your body, and can it affect your area of your esophagus or your stomach and create any problems there? Thank you.
Okay.
So this is the $64,000 question. We don't know the answer to that because it hasn't really been studied longer than for about 2 months. We know that the virus can be, or its genetic material can stay around for quite a long period of time. The spike protein can stay around for quite a long period of time, at least 2 months. It may even stay around for a year. It stays around in various parts of the body. It can stay in the gut, in the colon, maybe in the stomach, probably not so much in the stomach. It will travel through the esophagus and the stomach, and it can bind to some of those tissues and stay around for some period of time.
Right.
It's hard to know how long and what that means. So, there's, in general, a lot of these questions that are really good and interesting questions that objective science would want to have addressed have not been addressed because if you look for something, you have to be prepared to accept the answer that you get. And if you're not prepared to deal with an answer that you don't like, then you don't do the study in the first place.
So just following up on Kathy's first part of her question, how long does mRNA stay in? I mean, does it change your DNA, as some people argue? Is it with you for life? Does it filter through the body? What happens with that in terms of the biology there?
And can it get into the next generation also?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Right. So the answer is that normal mRNA, as in regular viruses, does not stay around very long because RNA is highly degradable in the body, and its function in real life is only to stay around a very short period of time before it gets taken apart and reused. But what's happened in these vaccines, in order to make the mRNA more immune provoking, they changed one of the letters in the genetic code from a normal letter to one that's artificial.
Yeah.
And it's very similar in shape to the molecule that codes for that letter, but it's changed enough that the enzyme that takes it apart can't do it. And so what that did is it makes the mRNA still work like mRNA, but the enzyme that takes it apart has a lot of difficulty taking it apart, and so the mRNA lasts a lot longer. And this was done on purpose, nominally, so that the mRNA would be around long enough to make enough of the spike protein that the immune system would respond to it. But it has the undesirable effect of keeping the mRNA around for too long. Now, there are enzymes in humans that turn the mRNA into DNA, and DNA floating around in the nucleus of a cell can get incorporated into the DNA of the cell itself, as well as it can be made DNA and just sit around as parallel DNA, like another chromosome, except it's just a little snippet of, relatively speaking, of DNA, and sit there in the cell. And once you have DNA in the nucleus of a cell, the enzymes that split the DNA strands, make new ones, and all that, when cells divide, will do the same thing for the snippet that's sitting on the side as it will for the regular chromosomal DNA. So it can propagate either by inserting into the regular DNA or just sitting there in the nucleus of the cell. These things can happen. They've been shown in lab studies, but not, as far as I know, in human studies. But you have to remember something, which is that human DNA, with its gigantic amount of letters that encode the DNA, has long stretches whose function we don't know, that have sometimes been called junk DNA. Yeah. And some of these are actual codes for viruses that we've encountered in the past. Wonderful. You know, the evolutionary past. Yeah. And so if viruses can insert themselves into human DNA, then probably vaccines can do the same thing.
Wow.
But the consequences of this is, you know, something on an evolutionary scale, not on a personal scale. So we don't really know how much the DNA could get into our cells, the RNA could get into the DNA in our cells.
Time will tell, that's for sure. Doctor, hold the thought. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll grab a few more of your calls. Plus, a little bit later, the attorney in the Hoke case will be joining me. We'll give you an update on that. So we got a lot to get into. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining me. It is good to be here with you today. Not that long ago, probably moments ago, maybe an hour or so ago, that pro-life hero Mark Hulk was found not guilty on all accounts after the Department of Justice raided his home on trumped-up charges. I'll tell you what went down. We're going to actually be speaking to his lead counsel in just about 10 minutes here. If you're just joining me, Dr. Harvey Risch is here, and it's always a pleasure to have him to tap into his expertise. He's a professor emeritus of epidemiologists at the Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine. We're talking COVID, all the latest with the vaccine, some of the news that's coming out, some of the studies that we are now seeing, and what you need to know. And doctor, it's great to have you back here with us. Before I jump back into the phones, very quickly, you and I were talking a little bit at the break, and you wanted to follow up on this discussion we had a little bit earlier about gain of function.
Well, so in the Project Veritas release, the Pfizer responded late Friday night with a press release of their own saying that they actually do gain of function research in a limited context, which is to say that they try experimenting with the virus to see if it will retain the ability to be treated by Paxlovid. Mm-hmm. And they also asserted that the government makes them do that. Now, that's not exactly the same as gain of function in order to necessitate a new vaccine to cope with a new virus that would somehow be in circulation. That in that case, what one would do as a company is to try to make a virus that's more infective, say. And you do that by studying this can be done by what's called computational chemistry, which is there's now sufficient computing power and sufficient programming that you can take the physical structure of the spike protein and change it a little bit, you know, in a specific place, and then try to match that to the structure of the antibody and the cellular receptor and do all this marvelous technology on computer and see if you improve the ability of the virus to stick, to do what it wants to do. And you can march all over the entire surface of the spike protein and do that and see what optimizes its ability, all this by computer. And then when you find a way of doing that, then you make a real virus according to your design and then try it out in lab studies. So all of this is possible to do. And that is what would be called more traditional gain-of-function research or directed evolution, to try to make a virus that's as infective as possible. And there's only one reason for doing that, and that is to sell a vaccine that corresponds lock and key to that particular virus. You have to realize that if they were to do that, there's no reason to have that vaccine if the virus isn't in circulation. And there's no way for that virus to get into circulation unless somebody made it.
Right.
And the only person who's making it is that company because of the vaccine they want to sell. So if that virus actually got into circulation, it would be an act of domestic terrorism, of putting into circulation a virus that could kill people.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, unless it got leaked.
So either it's irrelevant or it's terrorism, and there's nothing in between.
Right. I mean, somebody could take it out of the lab and deliberately do that. Do you think the COVID origin came from a lab in Wuhan or from some meat market in Wuhan?
Well, it came from a lab in somewhere. It's not proven where it came from. Wuhan is the likely candidate because of circumstantial evidence, but it's provable statistically and biologically that it was engineered. And part of it is because it's got properties on the spike protein that are not in any other organism of more than 100,000 organisms, including viruses and coronaviruses that are in the U.S. NIH database, where you can check the sequences and compare sequences. And the sequence that's in it was in a Moderna patent from 2017 and before for a different gene. And so to get that to be inserted is something that can only be done by technology, and therefore, and there's other properties of it that make it even more specific than
that's
that.
That's fascinating.
So that can only be done by engineering.
All right. Jennifer in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Good afternoon.
I had read once that they are going to use the mRNA in all vaccines going forward, and I wondered if that was true or if that's someplace listed, and also if it's for infants.
Great question. That's great. This new technology, mRNA, they're very excited about it, from everything from flu doctor to cancer treatments. There was talk. Will we be using this technology moving forward to fight against these things?
You know, they may try to do that because, as they say, it's a cash cow. But the question will be, which part of the vaccine is toxic? We know the spike protein is toxic. We don't quite know about the mRNA, part of it. In general, we don't know about the other parts, that other things that are in the vaccine itself that could be toxic. This is all brave new world without evidence. And why we should be plunging into things headlong without doing very, very careful studies first is just, it's not like the public interest is being served here. There's corporate financial interest that's being served here.
Yeah. John, who's up next, Maggie? John in Boston, Mass. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, thank you, Drew, and thank you, Doctor, and thank you, Doctor, for being a voice out there. For anyone who's been paying attention, you've been a voice when other people have been refusing to speak up. But quickly, my question is, many people know that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are effective, but it's still sometimes difficult to obtain that. Are there any natural supplements? I've heard of a couple that might be substitutes for those compounds. Is anything that you know of that we can use to treat it and we can get over the counter at vitamin shops and things like that?
People use quercetin and EGCG, and don't ask me what that spells because it's too long to pronounce. And I don't know how effective they are. They work towards in the same direction, but not nearly as well as hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. I would say that both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin prescriptions can be obtained in clinical care by doctors seeing patients through telemedicine, through there's numbers of telemedicine groups that are out there. I have I'm affiliated with one as well, the wellness company. So you can get telemedicine consults, and there are pharmacies who are filling these prescriptions. So, you know, if you look around, you can get a prescription if you need it, if you get sick.
Well said. John, thank you. Appreciate the call. Doctor, I got to leave it right there. If people want more info on you, what's the best way to get connected?
The best way is to Google or web search for Risch, R-I-S-C-H, and Yale, Y-A-L-E. That has my faculty page. You'll find, and on it, it has my Telegram channel.
I'm so grateful for your time. So much to still get into and to talk about. Gates on this, and there's a lot of other issues. We'll have to have you back and dive into it a little more deeply, but I'm very grateful for the time you were able to give us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you. That's Dr. Harvey Risch. You can check him out. I'm going to take a short pause. When I come back, there was some breaking news a little bit earlier today, and I want to thank one of my former colleagues here for putting it on my radar. The lead counsel in the Mark Hoke trial is standing by. We'll talk to him. Mark was acquitted on both charges in what some are claiming is a major pro-life victory. Why are they saying that? I'll break it down for you right after this.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, this September, I'm heading the Relevant Radio's Eucharistic Revival Pilgrimage to Italy with Nativity Pilgrimage. This is available to you. Information available at relevantradio.com/Italy.
Taking care of business every day.
He has a microphone, and he knows how to use it. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, it is good to be here with you today. Some breaking news earlier in the afternoon. We've been following a big pro-life case, the case of a father of seven children. He was a pro-life activist and was actually defending his child. He was outside of an abortion clinic, and he was arrested on charges. He pushed this abortion clinic worker. FBI comes in a pre-dawn raid. They violate the free access to the clinic Entrance Act, which is the FACE Act, and they were worried he could spend 11 years in jail, pay $350,000 worth of fines. It'd be crippling for this father. The jury had deadlocked. If you were following the story, I was being reported a little bit earlier that was the case, and then after about 2.5 hours of debate, the judge told them, look, take the weekend off, come back, try again on Monday. Well, they came back, and they delivered the right verdict. He was found not guilty. Bruce Love, the clinic escort who got into the confrontation with Hulk, basically kept claiming that he never spoke to his son. But when Mark Jr. took the stand, he testified directly that, no, he did speak to him. And look, this is pure speculation, but if I was on the jury, that would have kind of cinched it for me, too. I'm joined right now by the executive vice president and the head of litigation for the Thomas More Society. They've been defending Mark in this trial. You can find them out, find more about them at thomasmoresociety.org. And it's a pleasure to have with me Peter Breen. Peter, welcome. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate your time today.
Drew, it is so good to be with you.
I was reading a quote that you had a little bit earlier. You said, we took on Goliath, the full might of the United States government, and we won. And you did. A lot of people are calling this a major pro-life victory. Maybe elaborate on that if you could. What was the significance of today's victory, and what's it portend for the future?
Well, and the real danger of this case was it was a test case by the Biden Department of Justice. I'm sorry, Obama was the last one we fought off on this topic.
Right.
They wanted to come after this is the first time they've ever prosecuted a sidewalk counselor for an altercation with an aggressive abortion clinic escort. So the idea is if every squabble on the sidewalk can be jumped on, and when you've got, especially in this case, there involved some incidents where there was no video, it was just a he said versus he said, If every one of those incidents becomes a federal felony, you know, we're looking at 11 years in a penitentiary for it,
wow,
it would utterly chill sidewalk counseling across the country, especially in places where they've got real aggressive abortion escorts. But think about it. If we give these abortion escorts free license to essentially provoke these confrontations, very, very hard environment for a sidewalk counselor to be involved in. In this case, I mean, we got a full victory, unanimous verdict, not guilty, both counts. And I'll tell you, yes, the jury was deadlocked on Friday. Well, the jury came in this morning. We had some issues, and one of the jurors was excused. We had to call in the alternate juror to drive into the city and come and join the other 11 jurors in progress. That alternate juror was seated. Within an hour, they had a verdict.
Wow.
So it was clear that, at least, you know, looking at it from an armchair perspective, it was the juror that needed to be excused that was causing the deadlock. And once you had 12 jurors who were, you know, ready to deliberate and be a part of the process, we got that clear not guilty verdict. Yeah. So it was really only an hour.
That's
that the
fantastic.
Whole jury deliberated.
That's amazing.
You
motioned for a dismissal of the case. Is it better that the jury acquitted him? That actually is more favorable, correct?
Well, it's certainly, I think it's great for Mark Houck. And it's also great because, yes, you can't say, oh, a judge, you know, the judge went the wrong way or whatever. So, look, 12 independent people who didn't have a dog in the fight from all over the Philadelphia area. And I mean, they were of all races, creeds, job descriptions, ages. They came together and very quickly saw through the government's case. And you know, the government, they sent in the top guy who does face litigation from Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So they brought in the guy who wrote the book
on
prosecuting face cases.
Wow.
Yeah, and they had an extremely skilled prosecutor from Philadelphia, from the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, we were up against their best. And we had retained to assist us and lead the charge a gentleman named Brian McMonagle, who is the finest criminal defense attorney in Philadelphia. Yeah. Based on his performance, he's one of the finest trial attorneys in America.
Wow.
So we were able to combine our forces at Thomas More Society with expertise, with his, you know, his ability to speak Philadelphia and do
right.
wonderful things in the courtroom. And so between us, we were able to get this done. And it, again, huge victory. When you win like this, it's okay to spike the football because, you know, there are plenty of times we're up against it and, you know, we're not successful in the trial court. We got to go on appeal or whatever.
Yeah.
It's better just to win in front of the jury, get a nice definitive verdict like this one.
Well, you went up against the best, but that makes you the best, right? You took them down, Peter. I love it. I love it. Yeah, a lot of people praying for you, though. We've been following the case. We've been praying for this poor man. And again, this really was a case about a father defending his child, right? More than it was anything else.
Right. And what happened on the eve of trial? So the weekend before the trial, the prosecution added the CEO of the local Planned Parenthood to the witness list. We had no clue she was coming. She came and they provided us the patient escort manual that Planned Parenthood uses and the job description. And in no uncertain terms in that manual, we're reading it over the weekend as we're about to start trial on Tuesday.
Yeah.
They said, there's a strict non-engagement policy, and it was in bold letters and it's capital. And we're going, this aggressive escort was engaging like crazy. He was using vulgarity. He was, sorts of stuff. So the Planned Parenthood CEO gets on the stand. The first thing she has to admit is, yeah, he violated our policy. And then and based on another email we'd received the night before the trial, it turned out he'd been suspended from being an escort.
Wow.
Based on his violations of the policy. So that's how the trial started.
Wow.
And then we get into the actual altercation and all of that. And just the aggressive escort had actually, he had stood 3 feet from the then 12-year-old Mark Jr., 3 feet away from this young man, Mark's young son.
Yep.
Just horrible things, really. But again, great victory for the Houck family, great victory for the pro-life movement. And now, I got to tell you, we're already hearing from Congress about the abuses of the FACE Act, and I am hoping that Congress calls Mark down there to testify, to talk about what the DOJ did to his family with that raid on their home and what they did with this prosecution.
So two things. What's this do for the DOJ? And two, is there something the Justice Department can do? Can they appeal this? Are you out of the woods now? Or, you know, what's the future hold?
Praise God for our jury system. When you are a criminal defendant, you are acquitted. It is done. There are no appeals. it's done. You are a free man, and you don't have to, you know, you don't have to worry about it. And so that there, you know, that is part of our system. It's a wonderful thing. I am hoping that the Department of Justice goes back, having received this loss, big public, you know, I'm sure they're going to try to minimize it. They're going to try not to, you know, try not to talk about it or whatever. So we, you know, we who are people of faith and people of life, you know, we need to make sure they don't. They're not able to sweep it under the rug. We've got to keep the focus on it. And I am hoping that because of that, they will go back, reevaluate, and stop harassing sidewalk counselors, because we have got to have those folks on the sidewalk providing alternatives to the women who are going into those clinics. I mean, they are the last chance for those little babies and for those women of having to bear a lifetime of, you know, of these after effects of these abortions.
Yeah. There were other arrests, if I'm correct, of pro-lifers after this. I don't know whether they're arrested on the same type of charges, violating the FACE Act. Does this case impact those at all, or they're totally independent scenarios?
Well, and those folks, and we're representing nearly all of them, or at least we're involved in nearly every one of those other cases as well. They're the more standard, you know, the sitting in front of the door and singing religious hymns, you know, the sort of thing, totally peaceful. And those folks are facing years in a penitentiary for just, you're doing the same thing that civil rights protesters and other folks do. So that is unjust, what's being done to them. It is a different case, though, than Mark Houck. Mark was their test case.
Yeah.
They really wanted to nab him so that they could, you know, really strike fear into to sidewalk counselors everywhere. And that's why they sent 25 heavily armed federal agents to Mark's home to terrorize him in front of his wife and children. So it was good. We had, I mean,
25.
I hate to say that we had to win this. There were 25.
That's ridiculous.
Long guns, ballistic shields, battering rams. Yes. At his home.
Oh, gosh. That's not American.
I mean, yeah. Oh, it was horrible. But, and you know, you never want to say we absolutely had to win it.
Yeah.
But we did really need to win this case. And we did. And I mean, praise God for it. Mark is such a beautiful man. You know, he's a Catholic men's ministry leader. Mm-hmm. So I hope he'll get back up. You know, he was kind of under, he was under orders from his attorneys not to be out there doing too much talking. And now I hope he goes around the country and talks, both shares his faith story and talks about this case. Yeah. So hopefully he'll be speaking to men's groups and others all across the country.
He can have a second career for the next year or two. I'll tell you, everyone's going to want to talk to him. And what a story. I don't know what I would do in that situation. Face 11 years in jail, $350,000 worth of fine, 25 armed FBI agents invading my home. Yet I look at the vandalism of pro-life clinics and centers, the vandalism of Catholic churches. You barely get an arrest. I mean, where's the FBI? Where's the Department of Justice on what I really believe is a domestic act of terrorism? Let's grab a few calls for you. 888-914-9149. I only have a couple minutes, so if you want to get in, you got to do it now. Denise in Chicago wants to send her gratitude to you, Peter. Good afternoon, Denise.
Peter Breen, this is Denise Stout. Congratulations, Peter. How did you make it through the crowds on the streets after the Eagles game?
Well, you know what was funny? In our closing arguments, you know, we used PowerPoint slides. Yeah. And, of course, we had our team was the Eagles, and we had the 49ers for the government. And, you know, it was
– That's
and
brilliant.
It really, you know, they came through. Yeah.
That
you know what?
Brilliant.
That's that was awesome. The thing. So,
Peter, we were praying for you. Great. We were praying for you. Congratulations.
Thanks, Denise. Appreciate the call. Yeah, Peter, thank you. And my gratitude to Steve Grossclaws. I know he's with you. He's a friend of mine, a former colleague. I know he suggested we get you on. I'm grateful for you making time for us today. Your organization, let me put a plug in for it, because you do all this stuff pro bono, if I'm correct, right? ThomasMoreSociety.org.
Oh, yeah.
And I hope people will get behind and support you. I hope I never need your services, but if I do, I'm calling, okay? If people want to help you or learn more about you and your organization, what's the best way to do that?
Right. It's ThomasMoreSociety.org. Moore is with 1-0. ThomasMoreSociety.org. And you're right, Drew. I mean, we're like your insurance policy. You know what? You don't want to need us, but when you do, we're there for you.
Well, I love it. Well, congratulations. Celebrate, okay? Celebrate. Have a great day. And thanks. Look forward to next time we talk, okay?
All right. Thanks so much, Drew. See you.
You got it. That's Peter Breen, Executive Vice President, Head of Litigation for the Thomas More Society. They're in a victorious battle where he won a victory against a great injustice. Know a lot of prayer went into that as well. Love that last caller on Philly. Let me extend my gratitude. My condolences to the San Francisco 49ers. My compliments to what looks like the most dominant NFL team right now, the Philadelphia Eagles. Congratulations as well to the Kansas City Chiefs. And my condolences go out to, of course, the Cincinnati Bengals. So tough situation out there for some of those teams. But it's going to be a great Super Bowl. The Philadelphia Eagles will meet the Chiefs, and that is going to be something else. I was sharing a little bit earlier that I was so impressed by the quarterback for the Chiefs. The reporter threw a microphone in his face when it was over, wanted his reaction. Very first thing out of his mouth was, I want to thank God. I want to thank God. So Patrick Mahomes, bravo. Kicker's a good Catholic guy, too. He nailed that 48-foot field goal to put them in. And, if I wasn't an Eagle fan, I'd probably be rooting for the Chiefs, but it's going to be a great game either way. I don't have time today, but tomorrow, have you seen a lot of these ads during the NFL games recently where they're for Jesus? They're ads that say he gets us. Have you seen those? I did a little research into that. Tomorrow, I'll share with you a little bit. I think they're going to run an ad in the Super Bowl, too. Who's behind the he gets us ads, right? I'll fill you in on that and a lot more. Hey, thanks for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. If you missed anything, hit my podcast, okay? You can find it where podcasts are hosted, including Relevant Radio. And check out the Pilgrimage to Italy. Join me. We're going to have a great time. RelevantRadio.com.